Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 14th of July. John Becker is the communications director of Truth Wins Out. It's a gay rights activist group, and it recently conducted an undercover investigation. His organization had been receiving questions about the Bachman and Associates offices. It's a Christian counseling center in Lake Elmo, Minnesota, which is owned by presidential candidate Michelle Bachman's husband. The question was whether or not they were practicing reparative therapy, essentially trying to cure gay people. This is a form of therapy that the American Psychological Association has said to be unlikely to be successful and to involve some form of risk. As far back as 1997, the Council of Representatives of the American Psychological Association passed a resolution affirming principles with regard to treatments to alter sexual orientation. The principles include this: homosexuality is not a mental disorder, and the APA opposes all portrayals of lesbian, gay, and bisexual people as mentally ill and in need of treatment due to their sexual orientation. John made an appointment with a clinic. He wore long pants to conceal a tattoo on his ankle, the tattoo of a pink triangle, the badge of gay prisoners in Nazi concentration camps, and a symbol of LGBT equality. He said goodbye to his husband of 5 years, Michael, and headed to the clinic from Vermont. John and Michael recently moved to Vermont from Wisconsin. And to be honest with the audience, I will say that John and Michael are friends of ours and this program. This story has been picked up by all major news outlets in this country and also some foreign outlets. John Becker will be with us this hour. Later, Dr. Doug Haldeman, president of the Society for the Psychological Study of Lesbian, Gay, and Bisexual Issues for the American Psychological Association. We'll be welcoming phone calls. As we always do, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and you are also welcome to send us emails. That address is talk@wpr.org. John, good morning. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. It's an absolute pleasure to hear your voice.
Well, it's great to have you on the air, and you are everywhere, sir. This story has been picked up by all kinds of media outlets.
Yeah, it's been quite overwhelming, the interest in this story, but, you know, it's good to get this information out there.
So tell me about the process, when and why you decided that you were going to hop a plane to Minneapolis from Vermont, and also the process that you had to undergo to do this.
Actually, Michelle Goldberg from the Daily Beast contacted Truth Wins Out's executive director, Wayne Besson, several months ago and asked if we had known anything about the Bachman Clinic. And, she and many others had been, you know, passing these questions along because everybody had wanted to know. The Bachman Clinic had long been rumored to engage in reparative therapy, but those rumors were never able to be independently confirmed. So Truth Wins Out, Wayne decided that we would go in and try to investigate ourselves to, you know, either confirm or deny those rumors, and we would do so with hidden cameras so that we could document what we saw. And so that was when Wayne decided to send me undercover to Minneapolis, posing as a gay man who is struggling with homosexuality and wants to be rid of it, and to see what I was told and what kind of treatment I was offered.
I was interested, John, in what you did to present yourself as somebody who is struggling with homosexuality, because indeed you are a happily married man.
Absolutely, yeah. Michael and I have been married for over 5 years, and I couldn't be happier. So yeah, it was an interesting kind of, you know, mental game to put myself back into the place of somebody who was struggling with my sexual orientation. You know, I had, as a teenager, I struggled with guilt and with shame and with self-acceptance. So I was able to tap into my memory bank to get started with that. But it was a very emotionally draining experience to have to go in there and to lie about who you are and to omit from your entire life story, you know, the single person who makes life worth living to you. You know, that was a tough thing to prepare for. I had to kind of go through and systematically strip my identity, you know, that part of my identity out from my life. I had to take my human rights campaign credit card out of my wallet. I had to take the photo of Michael and I out of my wallet. I had to, you know, take Michael's picture off as the background of my cell phone, just kind of remove all possible reminders of that. I had to take off my wedding ring, but even that, and to prepare for this. So it really involved me stripping off that entire part of my life, which is, you know, the most important relationship in my life, to for the sake of going undercover and portraying myself as somebody who wasn't okay being who he was.
You had a hidden camera. Were you nervous about that aspect of this, that somehow somebody would realize, oh, this isn't really who he is? He's actually a happy guy.
Yeah, it was. I had never done anything like this before. No, I had never done undercover work at all. So, it was nerve-wracking. I had a hidden camera, a pinhole camera, in an army a little army surplus messenger bag. So that was one. And then I also had a camera disguised as a wristwatch, as well as a USB sound recorder disguised as a portable USB drive on a keychain. So I had three different sources, you know, for footage and for audio. So, yeah, it was quite the operation. I felt a little bit like James Bond. But I was definitely nervous just because I didn't have any experience doing this, and I had to kind of concoct an idea of what I would say if I was caught. And it was a little bit nerve-wracking, especially at first.
And did you go to this clinic specifically because Michelle Bachmann is running for president of this country?
That's why the interest in that clinic is so intense. Yes, and because Marcus Bachmann had been denying these allegations, and you know, as you mentioned, reparative therapy is completely discredited not just by the American Psychological Association, but by every mainstream medical and mental health professional organization: the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Counseling Association. All of them, you know, have come on record rejecting ex-gay reparative therapy, quote unquote, and saying that it can be harmful and dangerous, not to mention ineffective. So we thought the American public deserved to know whether or not the Bachmann Clinic, which Michelle is a co-owner of, engages in and endorses this dangerous practice.
Tell me about your sessions, John. There were five of them.
Yes, that's correct. I was a very eager patient. We tried to get as many sessions in as possible. I was there from June 23rd through June 30th were the sessions. And the first was, you know, was introductory in nature. And, you know, he took my personal and family medical and mental health history, we introduced ourselves and just kind of all of the preliminary stuff like you'd have at a first doctor appointment. But then, you know, after that, we rolled up our sleeves and kind of, you know, dug in. One of the major components of reparative therapy is that homosexuality is portrayed as unnatural. That there, you know, it's not viewed as, you know, a normal variation in human sexuality and a naturally occurring one at that. But rather, it's an unnatural condition, a treatable unnatural condition that needs to be repelled. It's not intrinsic to who a person is, but it's an extrinsic force. So because that's how reparative therapy people view homosexuality, they have to assign some kind of random cause for it. So a large component of these sessions was looking through my life, looking through my background to try to pinpoint one or more things that might have, quote-unquote, caused my homosexuality. I was asked if I had any emotional, physical, sexual abuse in my childhood, which I had not. I was asked about my relationships with my parents, if they were good, which they are, if there were any dysfunctional or unhealthy family relationships, which there aren't, you know, and he really went on what I call a fishing expedition to try to discern what might have caused my homosexuality. But he made it very clear that change from gay to straight is possible. To his credit, he didn't promise that it could necessarily be total, but even the president of Exodus International, which is the country's biggest ex-gay organization, says that on a day-to-day basis, he struggles against doing what comes naturally to him. So, and he's the most high-profile ex-gay in the country. So I was promised at the very least to be able to get my same-sex attractions down to a manageable level, but that it was quite possible to have them removed completely, which is that false promise is another major component of reparative therapy.
And you were given a plan of some kind, weren't you, John, that you should have a buddy with you who was heterosexual?
Yes. That's another major hallmark of these reparative therapy programs is the heterosexual accountability buddy, and it's sort of I kind of compared it to an Alcoholics Anonymous sponsor, where anytime I was advised that anytime I was feeling tempted or having sexual urges or anything like that to call this person up, to meet with this person, to pray with this person, we posed a hypothetical question where, you know, what if any of my gay friends, because I tried to keep my story as close to my own, like, as close to the truth as possible, because I figured it would be easier to keep track of than, you know, than making up a bunch of lies. So I came in, you know, my background is in music, and which is the truth. So I said, you know, what if some of my friends who are engaged, you know, my gay friends would get married and invite me to the wedding? And he advised me not to go to the wedding unless I had my heterosexual accountability buddy with me, you know, to help me guard against temptation.
There were also, I found interesting, there was a picture of, tell me about this woman who's very involved in the ex-gay movement, and evidently she had a book that was on display with encouragement to listen to her story.
Yes, her name is Janet Boynes, and she's a minister in the Twin Cities that Truth Wins Out is very familiar with. She's a self-proclaimed ex-lesbian, and we've dealt with her several times, so I was familiar with her face. And I was sitting in the waiting room of Bachman and Associates, and I turned my head, and just off the waiting room is where they had a whole shelf full of books that they were selling, and I saw Janet Boynes' face. And I was, oh my gosh. So after my appointment that day, I went over to the book area, and I found the book, and it's called Called Out, A Former Lesbian's Discovery of Freedom, and it's all about how Janet Boynes, you know, was quote unquote called out of the lesbian lifestyle. So it's an ex-gay book, and it's being sold to Bachman and Associates. But not only was it being sold there, but there was a note on the wall behind the stack of books, a typewritten, prominently displayed note that read, "Janet is a friend. I recommend this book as she speaks to the heart of the matter and gives practical insights of truth to set people free." And it was signed by Marcus Bachman, Ph.D. So there was an explicit endorsement of the ex-gay movement and of ex-gay therapy signed by Marcus Bachman on the wall. So that was very important as well to find.
Have you heard anything from the Bachmans as a result of all of this, you personally, John?
I have not been personally contacted by the Bachmans as a result of this. And actually, it's interesting. The computer system for Bachman and Associates allows you to book 3 appointments in advance. Every time I would come in, I would book out that 3rd appointment because, you know, obviously, to me anyway, it would raise suspicion if somebody came in for something like becoming un-gay and, you know, thought they could only, you know, only booked 5 appointments. So I wanted to make sure that they thought that I would keep coming back. And even after the story has, you know, broken on ABC, NBC, MSNBC, CNN, et cetera, all these news outlets, they must not have removed me from their computer system, because just yesterday I got a reminder email reminding me of my appointment with Timothy at Bachman and Associates at 5:00.
So
I thought that was a little comical. So, you know, that's about the extent of the contact I've received from Bachman and Associates.
Oh, John, I think you should go.
I wonder what they would say.
I wonder what they would say as well. Put yourself back. You said that you conjured up who you were as a young adolescent when you realized you were gay and it was a struggle for you. Put yourself back then. If you had been that young person, that young adolescent going into that clinic, what do you imagine it may have done to your psyche? I guess I'm getting at what may be the danger of this.
Well, the danger of this is that it tells lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people that the person that they are is wrong. My therapist told me twice that God created us all for heterosexuality. So the clear implication there is that homosexuality is unnatural. So you know that key component of who you are, that part of your identity, is unnatural. And when you're telling emotionally vulnerable people that there's something wrong with them, that has the potential to have very serious psychological consequences. At Truth Wins Out, we hear from people every day who've survived these programs, but many of them have sustained serious emotional trauma that sometimes lasts for a lifetime. And actually, since this story has broken, I've received messages from close friends of mine saying, thank you for getting this story out. I was put into reparative therapy as a child. You know, people that I had known rather well but had no idea had gone through this experience in their own lives. You know, and so, you know, getting people, even in my own life, telling me this has affected me, this still affects me, is really, really powerful.
And why did you want to? This was a somewhat scary thing to do, to say the least, and required traveling and re-identifying yourself as a completely different person. Why do you want to do this, John? Why is this important to you, the work that you're doing?
Well, the reason I fight is the love I have for my husband, Michael. I fail to see how in any way people who love each other, you know, and people who are who they are openly and unabashedly, I fail to understand how that hurts anyone, how the marriage that I have with my husband does anything, you know, to hurt other people's marriages, how it can do anything but enrich our society, enrich, you know, the fabric of diversity that we have. So it's very, very important to me. My parents were musicians, and as a child, I did a lot of musicals with them. And a line from one of those musicals really, really jumps out at me in my head, and that's, "Who will speak if you don't?" And I really, you know, in my own life, try to remember that, because if I don't speak up for not just my own rights, but the rights of all the members of my community who are oppressed, who are, you know, in a sense, second class citizens in our society, then then I'm part of the problem versus part of the solution. So that's why it was really important to me to strike a blow for our community in exposing this therapy.
Mm. Were you surprised how many news outlets took on this story? You were the lead story on ABC News, for heaven's sake.
It was, I knew that the media interest was intense, but it was still something that I was rather unprepared for in terms of the whirlwind of it all. Yes, it was quite, you know, it's been quite the firestorm. But like I said, I'm just happy that this is getting out. You know, there clearly is a lot of interest, especially in the light of Michelle Bachmann's performance in the New Hampshire primary debate. She emerged as, you know, a candidate with a viable path to the GOP presidential nomination. So, you know, everybody is interested in her. Everybody is, you know, her life, her business, everything is coming under intense scrutiny. So I think that was a major reason why this story has had so much traction, and also because of the huge advances for LGBT equality that have been made.
Yes.
You know, the marriage equality ruling in New York that just happened recently, and, you know, our society is becoming so much more accepting so fast that the fact that these therapies, these roundly discredited dangerous therapies, are still being practiced in the 21st century, and also being practiced by, you know, at a clinic co-owned by a viable candidate for the presidency of the United States, is a pretty major story. So I guess in that sense, I wasn't surprised, but I have to confess I've been a little overwhelmed.
I would imagine it was quite something to see you in all of these places. You handled yourself very well. We'll find out from our next guest. John's going to stay with us, but we'll find out how widespread these reparative clinics still are, because we do think, I think, as John said, that things are changing rapidly in this country, but there are still a number of people also who are deeply religious, whose religions will say that the practice of homosexuality may be sinful. How do people deal with that if they have a very strong faith that adheres to that philosophy? Our guest, who's a psychologist, will deal with answering that question as well. But John is staying with us. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. John Becker is with us. He is communications director and really investigative reporter for Truth Wins Out, who recently went undercover at a Bachmann clinic in Elmo, Minnesota. And you have heard quite movingly his story. Dr. Doug Haldeman will be joining us, president of the Society for the Psychological Study of Lesbian, Gay, and Bisexual Issues with the American Psychological Association. We'll take a couple of your phone calls before we introduce Dr. Haldeman to the program. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Thursday, Ms. Nancy Pearl, will be joining us. Get your pens and pencils ready, please, because we talk about so many books that it's hard to keep track of all of them. So we will be talking about books with a woman who has read more seriously than anybody I know and gives great recommendations and can remember everything that she's ever read. And she's writing a novel as well, so we'll see how that's going. John Becker is with us right now. We're going to take a couple calls for him, and then Dr. Doug Haldeman will join us as well, starting our calls with Kathy in Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love this conversation because when I was 17, the guy I was, I'll call my first love, came out to me, and I had no idea he was gay. I mean, that would sound funny now, but this is a number of years ago, and I had no idea. And looking back on it, I think, well, this is a good experience because I find out gay people are just like the rest of us. It's not something to condemn. It's something to accept and say, well, hey, you know, different strokes, because I sure didn't choose to be straight. I can't imagine somebody making a conscious decision about that stuff. It's something to understand. So that's all I wanted to say about that. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kathy, for the call. John, want to respond?
Well, I think Kathy is absolutely right. You know, that as our society, as LGBT people become more visible, it becomes obvious that, you know, we're not those monsters, you know, somewhere off in the big cities, or those creepy people. You know, we're friends and family and neighbors and doctors and lawyers and musicians and students, and like Kathy said, it's, you know, we all want the same thing. We all want to love and be loved and be who we are openly, and, you know, different people have different sexual orientations. So I think it was just she put it so beautifully that we need to accept and love each other and for who we are.
Bob in Stevens Point. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Go right ahead. You may want to turn down that radio.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Turn down the radio, jerk. I'm just calling to state a fact. My partner and I have been together for 40 years. And the fact that we both knew we were gay when we were very, very young. I was in the fourth grade, and I was attracted to my teacher. I thought he was really, really swift. And my partner made a comment that he was attracted to his cousin. So, I mean, it's nothing that we're indoctrinated with. It's something that we're born with. And that's basically my comment.
John.
And a woman from Minnesota, that Dr. Marcus Bachman, I think is a quack.
John.
Bob, first of all, I'd like to congratulate you and your partner on 40 years together. That's really wonderful, and that's what my husband and I aspire to as well. So I wanted to congratulate you on that wonderful milestone in your relationship. I share your experience. I often tell people that I knew that I was gay before I knew what gay was. I didn't know what to call it. I didn't have any words for that, but I knew inside of me that was my sexual orientation. So like you said, this is not something that you choose. This is just a part of who you are. And, you know, and in my case, and it sounds like in your case as well, as, you know, in addition to, you know, everyone that I've ever spoken to, this is something that has been present in their lives for as long as one can remember having any feelings at all. So yes, I would agree as well that reparative therapy is quackery, but it's, you know, that doesn't mean that it's not dangerous and we shouldn't pay attention to it, because even though to the vast majority of us the idea that you can somehow pray away the gay is almost laughable, the fact is that there you know, many people still believe that and still are willing to send their kids, you know, or to send their kids into these programs that can get, you know, can inflict substantial emotional and spiritual harm to them.
Thank you very much for your call. Let's introduce Dr. Doug Haldeman, who is president of the Society for the Psychological Study of Lesbian, Gay, and Bisexual Issues for the American Psychological Association. He's a counseling psychologist in full-time practice in Seattle, Washington, and his concept of practices encompasses the LGBT communities and the relationship to mainstream American culture. How this relationship is enhanced by psychology is at the center of his professional focus and the heart of his passion. And Dr. Haldeman, thank you very much. John has been listening. You've been listening to John, so you understand his story, too, in case you haven't seen him all over television this week. Dr. Haldeman, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much. And yes, I have seen John and very, very proud of your work.
Thank you, Dr. Haldeman. That's an honor.
Also, just a quick correction. I'm a past president of APA's LGBT division as well as a past member of the APA Board of Directors.
Okay. Tell me how extensive, Dr. Haldeman, I think that John was right when we look at a gay marriage passing in New York and a great acceptance of this just being a natural part of life by more and more people in this country, that we don't realize that there are a number of clinics still operating that are trying to turn people from being gay to being not gay. How many clinics are there like this clinic in Minnesota?
The answer is we don't really know, because these clinics and these organizations, we have to also remember a lot of this takes place in a residential treatment format, ex-gay camps, ex-gay, you know, weekend retreats, if you will. So it's very underground, if you will, because this kind of treatment, and I use the word very much in air quotes, is so far out of the mainstream of any accepted organized mental health practice that they are underground. So we don't really know how many of them are. The other interesting thing, of course, about what John has done is expose sort of what goes on in ex-gay treatments, because we don't know that either. They are quite silent about what their methods actually are or how they purport to make them work.
Mm-hmm. This other thing that we should talk about is the money for these clinics. You were concerned, I know, John, that there is federal money involved in this.
Yes, one of my concerns was that Michelle Bachmann has really made a staple of her political career. In addition to making homophobia a staple of her political career, she's also made railing against, you know, government assistance programs like Medicare, Medicaid, things like that. And the Bachmann Clinic has accepted thousands and thousands of dollars in federal Medicaid funds, so that hypocrisy is a little bit, you know, was a little bit interesting to deal with and to see, especially in light of the revelations that the clinic does practice reparative therapy. I don't think it's appropriate for federal money to be flowing to institutions that practice something that, as Dr. Haldeman said, is roundly rejected by the medical and mental health communities. So that's troubling. But also, the clinic has received grants from the state of Minnesota for employee training programs and things like that. So again, there's an additional issue of taxpayer money being used to support clinics that practice these dangerous therapies.
I would, if I can just also add to what John just said, we need to remember this is a person who wants to be in charge of health care. I mean, think about that. This is a person, Michelle Bachmann, who is opposed to what President Obama's been doing, and she's got a better idea for health care, and this is the kind of health care that she clearly supports in terms of her own family, something that is widely regarded by credible mental health professionals as quackery.
Let me ask you about the religious question involved in this. She is what you might call a fundamentalist Christian. There are a number of religious groups that hold this as a tenet of faith, really, that homosexuality is sinful, and how they treat people who are homosexual may vary from place to place. How do you deal, and I know you've written about this extensively, how do you deal with this religious part of this equation, Dr. Haldeman?
It's a very sensitive area. As you point out, our research indicates that almost all people who seek to change their sexual orientation or modify their sexual expression through some kind of treatment, therapy, prayer, whatever, are in fact coming from a conservative religious background. And for many people, I saw my first ex-gay survivor in 1983, and since that time I've been working with people who've been all through all sorts of means, including electric shock and the use of emetic drugs earlier. You know, we saw more of that in the 80s. to change their sexual orientation, the motivation being so powerful. The premise is that it is not possible to change your sexual orientation. It certainly is possible to change your religious identification or affiliation. So, of course, one option that many people follow is to try and pursue a spiritual or religious path that is much more open and affirming and accepting of the individual, as opposed to trying to force her or him into being someone that they aren't. That doesn't always work, but of course there are evangelical groups now that are pro-gay and places where people can still get the sense of religious or spiritual community without having to try and either enter into fraudulent relationships, which is another aspect of this that we, you know, need to take a look at, or, you know, just live a life of celibacy. The hard part, of course, comes when families are involved that are, you know, can be so rejecting and so just oppressive, leaving the individual sort of in this netherworld between not really fitting into the gay community yet, but having been thrown out of their families. So there are a lot of complicated issues that we see in treatment here.
I would imagine, I was asking John, he has very supportive parents, but if he had been one of those young people who at the age of 15 was sent to one of these clinics and told by his family and his immediate extent and his extended family and friends, listen, you got to be straight here. This isn't acceptable. Our religion doesn't condone this, and we don't condone this. How hard it would be for a 15-year-old with all of these outside pressures on him or her to confront this. How would you deal with that?
Well, it is extremely difficult, and as you mentioned earlier in the program, the consequences of younger people being forced into these treatments can be far-reaching because the brain is so plastic at that age. Our brains, you know, we have research now to indicate that our brains really are developing until we're 25 years old, and so it is dangerous in the extreme for people to be exposed to treatments or therapies that make them feel terrible about who they are and then make them feel even worse for not being able to change it. You know, it's well known in this country we've seen a rash of gay suicides, you know, as the result of bullying. But this is another kind of bullying. This is a kind of emotional or psychological bullying. What I will say, though, that is interesting about how this story has been impacting the news cycle over the past month is I can remember a time when conversion therapy or reparative therapy was sort of standard treatment for homosexuality. And now it is a cultural outrage. And I think that's, you know, that's something to be very, very interested. What John says is right. We're changing very quickly in terms of our attitudes about LGB identity.
Mm-hmm. Did you struggle with questions of faith when you were struggling with the issue of being gay, John?
Yes, I did. My religious background is Catholic, and like I said, well, you know, my parents are wonderfully supportive, but the Catholic Church is not. The Catholic Church holds the position that being gay is not, you know, that homosexuality itself is, you know, is morally neutral, but acting on, you know, so it was a very strange thing for me because, you know, it's essentially saying, so, you know, being gay is neutral and whatever, but the sexual, physical, and emotional expression of that is somehow sinful. So that was a very difficult thing to try to deal with, and eventually, I had to reject that because I didn't find that, you know, I found that to be, you know, I mean, to be spiritually abusive, and you know, I couldn't apply that to my own life. And I did want to point out too that my parents and my immediate family have been and are wonderfully supportive and affirming. But you know, but there are some relatives on my side of the family as well as Michael's that do subscribe to more fundamentalist religion and still make their disapproval of, you know, Michael's and my marriage known to us. So, you know, it's even in our family, you know, and we consider ourselves very lucky to have the support system that we've had. And even in our extended families, there are people who remain intolerant.
Let's go to more phone calls for both of you. Tom in Burlington, hi.
Today is the anniversary of the birthday of my nephew, Patrick Corcoran Boyle. And He walked out of one of the biggest mansions on Chicago on Astor Street a couple of years ago and jumped in Lake Michigan and died from hyperthermia. And he left a note in the library. But so after that, my family are lawyers. A lot of people in Wisconsin know the Boyle family, our name, and we haven't made any secret about the fact that our nephew died. And out of honor of him, I'm going to tell you something. We lawyers, when we have a suicide or something, we never had one. Lawyers always go and get experts. So my family got experts. We look for experts and look for facts. And we did all this research, and we came up with this study. It was called the No-Name Study, that no one had a name, so no one knew they were being studied. And we studied alcoholics and straight people and gay people and all in between. And the No-Name Study came to the conclusion that all men and women who are mammals are bisexual by nature, biology, strategic survival of the human race. It has been a part of human activity ever since we were on this planet.
Tom, thank you for the call. I'm very sorry about your nephew. Dr. Haldeman.
Yes, hello.
Yes, hi. Is it, as you examine all this, completely natural? Is it part of our species to be bisexual?
Well, I don't know that we would, in psychology, go so far as to make that claim. Certainly, it is something that you hear, but it also calls forward the difference, if you will, or distinction between sexual orientation and sexual identity, in that some people choose to identify in a particular way, whereas orientation is not viewed as a choice at all. So what people endorse, of course, about their own sexual feelings and behavior isn't necessarily always the exact story. I mean, that's sort of how you get all these tales of ex-gay conversions, is that there's so much cultural pressure that's internalized that, that makes people make the claims that they do.
We go next to Dan in Reedstown. Hi, Dan.
Hello, how are you?
All right, how are you, Dan?
Good. I had a question kind of following a different track a little bit. As I understand it, except there's been some discussion about children being brought to...
Can you get a little closer to your phone, please?
How's that?
Yeah, it's much better.
Okay. There's been some discussion about kids being taken to reparative care clinics. I'd like to put that aside for a second and talk about adults. The context here was that the gentleman was... He presented himself as someone who was struggling with his own sexual identity. In other words, he presented, I have a problem. I sense I have a problem. No one told me I have a problem. I didn't, that's what he made a great deal about, is having to put aside the fact that he had no problem. He was trying to create that image.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, I mean, it would seem like, and my understanding of things, is that a lot of people struggle with their sexual identity. I shouldn't say a lot. There are people who struggle with their sexual identity, no matter what it is. That they're uncomfortable with it. Someone just used the word endorse. They can't endorse their own sexual identity, and it creates a tension in themselves, and it's a psychological struggle. And my question is, I mean, fine, if the data says reparative therapy can't help these people, and whether they're heterosexual or bisexual or homosexual or whatever, or have sexual desires or identities that are beyond the scope of that discussion, what can help them? There was a little bit of an allusion to, well, you could be celibate. I mean, or something. I mean, I don't think that was the direct answer to this sort of question. But are there therapy? I mean, what do you do with if someone like that presents to you as a psychologist and that presents to you with that struggle? What kind of therapeutic maneuvers? What kind of therapeutic models can work?
Okay, that's a good question. John, what would have helped you when you were a teenager? Who would have put your mind at ease?
Well, Dan brings up another important point for what I found in the visit, which was that, I did present myself as somebody who was struggling with sexual orientation issues, but if this therapist in this clinic had been acting
under the ethical standards of the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association, somebody who, you know, and, you know, Dr. Haldeman will be able to correct me if I'm misinformed on this, but somebody who would come in and report those issues would be told that, you know, that reparative therapy has no foundation in research, is dangerous, can lead to elevated risks of depression and suicide, and et cetera, and would be told about alternative therapies, including gay affirmative therapy that they could seek, and you know, things like that, but steered towards a more positive acceptance and embrace of that part of their natural intrinsic identity. So that would, you know, that would have been the course that would have been in line with the ethical standards of all of these, you know, mainstream medical and mental health bodies. But that was not the course that was taken. I was not. That's a important component of what I understand it to be called informed consent. And I was not given any of that information before I sought my treatment. So I think, you know, I presented myself as somebody who sought that treatment, but I should have been told that that treatment does not work, and I was not.
Dr. Haldeman.
The caller raises an interesting question about what you do. And how you see the roots of discomfort with one's sexual orientation. First of all, let me make it clear. In almost 30 years of clinical practice, I've never seen a heterosexual person come in and say, gee, I'm uncomfortable being straight. Can you make me gay? It's always the other direction because of the internalization of negative social attitudes about homosexuality. People believe the mythology that gay people do not or cannot lead productive lives or have stable relationships or that they're doomed to be unhappy or that they're going to face rejection. And all of this causes great pain internalized. And the way that I think is most helpful is through, first of all, a resolution of that pain, and secondly, education and guidance about the truth about sexual orientation. And that's what we try and promote is therapies or treatments, whatever they may be, whether they're psychoanalytic or behavioral, that are rooted in the science of sexual orientation and not the mythology, not the religion. We have great respect for the effect of religion on the psyche, but, you know, we shouldn't be trying to practice religion as mental health practitioners.
Mm-hmm. I want to take an email because it certainly shows how this is still so much a struggle for a number of people. This is from Jody. As a member of the LGBT community, I want to thank you for this discussion. As a child, I grew up in fear of letting people know about my true self. Over some 50 years, I've come to learn that being open and honest with yourself and others is the key to acceptance and leading a happy, productive life. Whoever would like to respond to her.
Jody, here, I raise my glass because that's exactly how I feel. And I can tell you from my own experience, too, having struggled to come to that self-acceptance. I didn't share it with my parents. I battled it out within my own self. I battled, as Dr. Haldeman said, the societal and cultural homophobia that we all have internalized. I battled that inside myself, you know, quietly for a long time, and there was nothing more liberating to me to come to the conclusion that I had spent years trying to get rid of a part of me that never was gotten rid of. So the only possible conclusion could be that this is who I was supposed to be, and to know that and to own that and to accept and to love myself and to realize that I could be a whole person, a happy person, you know, and a happily married person, you know, as a gay man, I can't think of anything that was more liberating. So I applaud Jody for what she said and thank her for sharing her story.
Dr. Haldeman.
Absolutely. I think that's the key to being able to live an integrated life, to live with yourself, is to come to acceptance and to recognize. I mean, we don't just say in psychology anymore that homosexuality is not a mental disorder. We say it's a normal variant of the human experience. And to be able to understand and to comfort yourself with the knowledge who you are is just perfectly fine. This is the way that you are, and live your life accordingly. And if you can visualize it in terms of productive life, long-term relationship, absolutely you can have it. And so I'm echoing everything that that John has said about that.
I'm so struck by what you just said, which seems so simple, a normal variant of the human experience, and how we have struggled with this for years and years, and people have died and been hurt psychologically and physically because we can't accept that.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we need to counter the misperception that a lot of people have that there's something flawed or wrong.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our lines have been just jammed, as have our emails. We'll make sure that these get to our guests because we won't have time to get to all of them. But more phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to your phone calls, we go to an anonymous caller in northern Door County. Hi.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I know your lines are naturally jammed. Well, my first question is, and I've only been listening to part of the show, and that is to ask when I guess the other side might have an hour on public radio. But I'd like to just say that if someone
will invite somebody from the Bachman Clinic to be on this show, if that's what you're asking.
Well, or maybe not the Bachman Clinic, but just the other side of the whole issue, not just the one person who's been sort of
What is the other side you want to hear?
Well, I mean, the side, I guess, of the fundamentalist religious side, who are now sort of portrayed as unnatural or unnormal or intolerant, and I think that's sort of a generalization that doesn't fit with the community that I'm familiar with.
All right, thanks for the call, Dr. Haldeman. Is there another side?
Well, I think what's interesting is now we are seeing the, if you will, quote-unquote, other side, which has so long been dominant in American culture through, you know, Christian privilege, now portraying itself as having been victimized here, which I think is just an absolutely stunning misrepresentation. I mean, we have been hearing the other side in this culture for decades, and I think now it's time for the truth about what some of this stuff is that is so harmful to the lives of so many people to be exposed.
And can I, may I cut in on this as well?
Of course, John.
I'd like to just add that, you know, to add to what Dr. Haldeman said, there comes a point in a culture where we in a society where we reach a new level of understanding, to ask for, you know, the other side in this issue, does that mean that we have to, you know, would be equivalent to asking, you know, like a David Duke to appear on television alongside Ben Jealous of the NAACP? There comes a point where we need to call bigotry bigotry, you know, call a spade a spade. This, you know, intolerance is intolerance, and you know, people are uncomfortable when they have to confront their own intolerance. That happens to all of us. That's a natural human reaction. But just because, you know, we don't need to make accommodations for bigotry, we need to, you know, to keep moving forward and exposing it for exactly what it is.
Mark and DePier, hi.
Good morning. Good morning, Kathleen. I'd like to point out first that John Becker is a friend of mine.
Okay.
But I have a question for the doctor. A parallel was made between, say, a sponsor for someone struggling with alcoholism and a gay person having an accountability buddy. Is there any value to that, or is it just an instant comic classic?
I have to say that I reject the premise that the concept of the accountability buddy in this treatment format is reasonable. I think most people who work through addiction or chemical dependency in a 12-step format would say that there is a legitimate value to having a sponsor or a contact person. Here, we're talking about the attempt to treat something that clearly is not an illness or a problem. The problem is the internalized perception that it is a problem. And, you know, if there's any sort of role for an accountability buddy here, it should be to reinforce that the person is not, in fact, suffering from anything other than internalized misperceptions.
Let's take an email. I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. It's gone too fast. From Amanda, who says, Dr. Haldeman, I'm a psych grad student. Can't clinicians that work at these clinics have ethics complaints filed against them with the APA?
Ethics complaints are processed based on our code, which is enforceable. And there are a number of aspects of the code that conceivably, for instance, giving out misinformation to patients, not giving adequate informed consent, engaging in discriminatory practice, these are all violations of the APA ethics code. So, you know, it would seem to me that depending on the situation, there's certainly possible basis for filing a complaint.
Oh, that's interesting.
It depends on the situation.
Oh, we're out of time. John, thank you ever so much for being with us and telling your story so publicly. I think it makes a difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathleen. It was just a pleasure.
And Dr. Haldeman, thank you very much for your expertise. We appreciate it.
My pleasure as well, and thank you, and thank you too, John, for your courage.
Mm-hmm. And thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we will return with a conversation about books. We'll have fun. Please get your pencils and papers ready so that you can write down the list of all these terrific suggestions that are about to come your way.